I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Koch brothers grew up in a wealthy family, but their father wanted them to understand the value of a dollar, so he made the youngsters earn every penny they spent. That lesson helped forge the empire that became Koch Industries, ruled for decades by two of the four brothers, Charles and David. Today we'll look at one of the most powerful and secretive corporations in America. From the guiding principles of the company, to breaking laws, to the passing last week of David Koch, we'll explore one of the most influential families in the corporate world, and we'll talk about the brothers' impact on politics and policies. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Most people around here have heard of Koch Industries. The Wichita-based company has made its leaders, Charles and David Koch, who passed away on Friday, two of the richest people in the world. In fact, this year, the two are worth more than $50 billion each, and their combined worth tops that of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. But here's a question. What do Koch Industries make? What does it do? And if the two Kochs are worth so much money and their company is so huge, why is answering that question so tough for so many people? Christopher Leonard, who was raised in Brookside, has answered that question and then some in a terrific new book, 7 Years in the Making, that examines the Koch business empire. That book is Kochland, The Secret History of Koch Industries and the Corporate Power in America. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, and Bloomberg Businessweek. Chris, it's nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've written this, if you eat, live in a house, wear clothes, drive to work, or use a phone, Koch Industries is probably making money at some point in the supply chain. And yet, I bet not two people out of 100 can tell you what they do. What do they do?
Well, that's a great question. I would put it as this company specializes in the kinds of businesses that underpin civilization. It's the kind of stuff we use every day, but doesn't carry a brand name on it. So Koch Industries refines the gasoline that people use to drive to work. It owns Georgia-Pacific, which makes the building materials, the wall panels in the buildings that we dwell in. It makes windows, carpeting, clothing material like nylon, Lycra, spandex.
Spandex, yeah.
Yeah. Critically, it makes things like nitrogen fertilizer, which people don't think that they use, but that's the bedrock of our modern food system. Mm-hmm. So you can start to see how this company specializes in these really complex industries at the root of everything we do every day, and they're tremendously profitable businesses.
One thing you didn't mention, Chris, is they make a lot of money from commodity trading. This isn't as well known. They have a global network here, if I understand right.
They have a global network of commodities trading desks that rivals anything on Wall Street, operated by J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs. And actually, I found this to be one of the most illuminating and important parts of the entire story. It took me years to really understand what trading is in general and why Koch is one of the largest traders of energy supplies, commodities, and derivatives in the world. I found that it's really at the heart of what this company is, this idea of trading. And if I could briefly tell you about it you
sure.
know, from the 70s, Koch was buying and selling energy supplies. And the whole strategy to being a trader is to learn more about what's going on in the world than anybody else knows. So you know what things are accurately worth. So you can buy something that's underpriced and sell it if it's overpriced. So Koch has built this internal data analysis machine that is amazing, and it allows them to buy and sell with greater knowledge and greater information than their competitors have. So that's why they make so much money in the energy business, and they've translated it into buying and selling actual other corporations, and that's how they came to be so large. So this is what's really at the heart of this institution.
You know, it's interesting to me about what you're describing here about their successes. They've done this without inventing a major new product or revolutionizing an industry, as you wrote. So this is how they did it. They did it by going their own way, in a sense.
They did it by going their own way, and they own these assets that are highly profitable, and that often, we just have to be blunt, sometimes they sit in these dysfunctional bottlenecks in our economy. I mean, maybe we could talk about oil refining, but that's delivered billions in profits to Koch Industries over decades. And the oil refining industry in America is very uncompetitive. We haven't built a new oil refinery in this country since 1977. So this is something that everybody depends on to live. And when you own some of these assets and operate them, you can just develop tremendous profits. And so it's the ownership of this kind of stuff that over time has built one of the largest private fortunes in the U.S.
Why is Coke and Coke Industries such a well-kept secret? Why is mystery? You think of Coke and mystery surrounds them. I covered politics in Missouri and Kansas for 25 years, and I didn't know much about them.
So secrecy is core to the DNA of this institution. And it's not just like this villainous James Bond kind of secrecy. It's the fact that, again, when we talk about trading, if you're going to be successful, you don't want other people to know what you know, and you don't want them to know what you're about to do. So there has been a culture of quiet certainty, of secrecy to this corporation. They don't brag. They don't boast. They don't seek attention. They just briskly go about the business of making billions of dollars.
So how do they feel about Christopher Leonard then stepping in and writing a very thick book about what they do?
Well, it's been a complicated relationship over many years.
This, I can only imagine.
This isn't a company that invites external scrutiny. And this isn't a company that likes, a lot of independent reporting about it. But I will say they did open the doors to a certain degree. I've interviewed Charles Koch. I've interviewed every current serving senior executive at the company. But that was, this is a process that's been going on for a long time. So it's been a sort of back and forth, push and pull relationship.
What was it like interviewing Charles Koch?
So to get to Charles Koch is not easy.
And
I'll never forget, they emailed me a special code on my cell phone. I held it up to a scanner, which opened the steel gates in the 10-foot-tall wall that surrounds Koch Industries headquarters.
Wow. And
you drive through there down a long road into the headquarters building, which is really a big black cube. Ushered in through security, up to Charles Koch's executive suite, and I walk in the door, and he looks at me and he says, "Chris, you didn't need to wear a tie to talk to me." Okay, that's Charles Koch. He is humble, charismatic. He displays a lot of humility, and that is what has engendered so much loyalty and admiration in the people who work for him, for sure. But I do want to point out that this kind of aw shucks Midwestern exterior masks a much deeper conviction inside this guy. He absolutely believes he knows how society ought to work, that he has discovered the blueprint for how society ought to be organized and how businesses ought to be run. And he has a spine of steel when it comes to promoting that point of view.
He calls it market-based management, right?
Absolutely.
And what is that?
I've never seen anything like this. I've been a business reporter for 20 years. So the book shows how from the 80s, Charles Koch started developing this management philosophy. But even that kind of undersells what this is. He has developed this philosophy for running a company, running a country, and running even your personal life called market-based management. And what he says it is sort of this codification of the rules of the marketplace. And so when you get hired at Koch Industries, you're going to take a 3 to 4 day seminar to learn the vocabulary, the concepts of market-based management, and you're going to practice that every day at the company.
I was going to say, you write this, Chris, when each employee is hired, he or she undergoes a multi-day training session to learn the tenets of Charles Koch's philosophy, market-based management, or MBM as they call it. Charles Koch says the philosophy is a blueprint for achieving prosperity and freedom. It is equally applicable to business ventures, personal habits, and national government.
That's right. And this is one of the reasons I call the book Kochland, is this is a group of people who are absolutely on the same page. They subscribe to the same.
He demands that, right?
He says in his own books that you either have, quote unquote, total conversion to market-based management, or you're doing it wrong. You either practice this belief or you're not going to succeed in that organization.
He prints market-based management on paper drinking cups found in the company's break room.
there's that. You walk through and the 10 principles of market-based management are taped up on the cubicle walls. When there's video conferencing and they have that kind of save screen, it's the 10 teachings of market-based management. It is baked into what you do every day.
So talking to Charles Koch was not an intimidating experience, it doesn't sound like.
Not in the slightest.
He made sure it wasn't that way.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How did it go? How much time did he give you?
Well, he gave me an hour, okay, which is not a lot of
time. Not a lot of time.
Not a lot of time. And I'm not even going to sit here and pretend that I got a window into this guy's soul from that hour, you know. But you do get a sense for how he operates. And in the interview, he is an engineer. He has multiple master's degrees from MIT in engineering. And again, I just want to restate this point that this is a person who believes that there are physical laws to the world, and then there are these kind of laws to how society ought to be shaped. And he told me in that interview that he believes he has discovered the laws of how you need to shape a society. And the thing is, just like the laws of physics, if you violate those, the thing's going to fall apart, whether you want it to or not. And this drives at, I think, the sort of unbending vision he has for running the company. And we might talk about this later, but, you know, for example, labor unions and Koch Industries.
I was going to ask you about that.
He might say in his head, I know you want more money, but the market will not support that. And if I give you money, I'm just trying to fight gravity of the market. So we all have to accept the pitiless verdict of the market system, and you need to accept less money. This is the kind of point of view. And I think in his mind, it's kind of inarguable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't he give you more time than an hour?
Well, he's a very busy guy. I mean, he's in his early 80s and his desk was covered in papers. And he, you know, he's a person who likes to be in control. That is one thread you'll see through his whole life. And controlling the narrative about Koch Industries and Charles Koch himself is a very important thing.
Did he try to control you?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I mean, he put forth his point of view during the interview. He has an entire public relations team whose job is to try to control reporters like me. And so they're very good at that. And, you know, they're out there right now trying to share the positive story about Charles Koch, which is a real thing. There is a positive story to tell. I feel that my job as an independent reporter is to show the positive, the downsides, the blind spots, some of the risks of somebody accumulating this much political and economic power. And so I think it's important for all of us to kind of consider the whole picture.
Did he express any concern about what you were going to write?
None whatsoever. I mean, I was there to actually interview him about market-based management. He mm-hmm. released his second book, but really his third book, when you include an internal company pamphlet, about that creed back in 2015. And he was more than happy to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. But did you try to go back and talk to him about the different chapters of the book?
I did. What I interviewed him about was the period of the 1990s, which was a disastrous period in Koch Industries history. They were fined record criminal fines. They were in court a lot. There was a bitter family fight. They made terrible acquisitions. And I really wanted to know how he grappled with those failures. That's what really interested me. So I was asking him how he confronted such failure. And he said, I do what I always did, which is I worked harder. And the reporting bears that out. When you look at what happened after the 90s, when you look at how this company grew exponentially almost during the 2000s and what it is today, you see that by having faith in his own belief system, he really did create a massive corporate empire.
Christopher Leonard is my guest. His new bestseller is titled Kochland. He'll be speaking at the library tonight at 6:30 at the Plaza Branch. But I should point out, the event is at capacity. The library is taking no more RSVPs. That doesn't happen very often. You can assume there's a lot of interest in Koch Industries in this neck of the woods, not far from where Koch Industries is based. Charles Koch, Chris, is described as intensely ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from in his life?
Great question. I mean, we have to go back to the 1950s or so in Wichita, Kansas. Charles Koch was one of four sons. Their father was Fred Koch, a wealthy, very conservative industrialist, a co-founder of the John Birch Society. Fred Koch drove his sons. Charles Koch talks about this a lot. I mean, Fred Koch, let's just say he was super intense. And he taught these young four children he had that life is a competition and that the lazy will fall behind. And I expect hard work out of you. I mean, Charles Koch has these stories of digging dandelions with a spoon out of the backyard when he was bad. Mm-hmm. And
he wanted his sons to know the value of a buck, right?
He wanted his sons to know that value and to almost prove themselves, I think. And I don't think it's a coincidence that at this point in his life, Charles Koch, I would argue, these are my words, I think Charles Koch has surpassed his own father's accomplishments in every arena. And I don't think that's a coincidence. When we talk about what drives this guy, it's not money anymore. The people around Charles Koch, I mean, Charles Koch still lives on the family compound in Wichita. He drives a sensible car. He doesn't own islands, as far as I know. He's driven by, I think, perhaps a need to show he is a true builder.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. He just lost his brother, mm-hmm. David, just last week. How does that impact the future trajectory of Koch Industries?
So, I want to be careful in my language, but David and Charles Koch split ownership of this firm, 50-50.
Two very different individuals, by the way.
Very different individuals. And what you see was that David moved to New York and lived the life of a high-profile billionaire. Charles stayed back home and operated this firm. And when I let's just say this. For years, I interviewed current and former Koch Industries senior executives. They didn't talk about David Koch. They talked about Charles Koch. He's the driving force here. And so I think that the strategic and operational impact of the tragic passing of David Koch, it won't be significant. This company is going to continue on a trajectory that it's been on, determined by other things.
Charles Koch is 83 years old. What happens if when he should pass?
So I can attest Charles Koch still arrives at work before the sun is up at times. I mean, and he is not relaxed. So we have to face the question, what happens when he steps away in whatever regard? There are three senior executives at the company right now who I think are kind of in a three-way race to take the CEO's job after Charles Koch. But I do believe that'll be an interim CEO position. Charles Koch has a son named Chase Koch, who I interviewed for the book. He's in his 40s, his early 40s. When Chase was born in the 1970s, some employees hung up a banner in Koch's office that said, "Welcome, Crown Prince." Hmm. That's the burden that's been on this young man for his whole life.
Wow.
Chase has been bred and raised, I believe, to take over this corporation. And I think someday he will. Now, the question is, can this company replicate the kind of explosive growth it had under this guy, Charles Koch? Can the thing operate without this personality at the top? It's an open question.
You know, it's interesting you're describing the son as being a likely, at least a temporary successor. You haven't mentioned any of the other brothers. There were four brothers altogether, two of whom didn't go into the business, or at least did and then separated at some point a number of years ago. What happened there? Because it was awfully acrimonious.
Acrimonious starts to describe it. There were four brothers. The oldest, Freddie, who would have been kind of the natural heir apparent, wanted nothing to do with the business. He has essentially not lived in Wichita, not been involved with the company his whole life. And then there's Charles and David, and then their brother, Bill. Bill actually tried to take the company over. He did not like Charles Koch's management philosophy. He did not like Charles Koch's very rigid belief system of keeping the thing private, plowing profits back.
He's kind of a black sheep, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he sued his brother. There was a corporate coup attempt. And what resulted was a legal battle that lasted 20 years for control of this fortune. And Bill Koch essentially lost that battle. Charles Koch retained control with David of the company. But the battle went even beyond the courtroom. Bill Koch was hiring detectives to dig through Charles Koch's trash.
Wow.
He was hiring people to pose as reporters. He was trying to plant negative stories about his brother. It created this embattled feeling inside the company and created a lot of damage to this family.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with Christopher Leonard here about his new book, Kochland. We'll turn and we'll get into the Koch's interest in politics and how they reshape national and state politics. And we're going to take your questions, too, at 816-816-816. 215-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to UpToDate on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. My email newsletter is being sent out every Monday. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske and get exclusive content from me, like yesterday's edition where I had something to say about crosswalks in this town. Now, I'm not taking credit, but this morning, just to point out, there was a city employee giving the crosswalks outside this station a new coat of paint. Read highlights from the UpToDate crew and see what I have to say next week. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske to subscribe. Well, men have long dominated the field of those who write opinions and editorials. Tomorrow on the show, we'll see how women can make their voices heard with a former female editor of the New York Times op-ed page. That's tomorrow on KCUR's UpToDate. Well, this hour, I'm visiting with Christopher Leonard. He has a new, freshly minted bestseller on the market. It's titled Cokeland, The Secret History of Coke Industries and Corporate Power in America. He's speaking at the Kansas City Public Library tonight, but the event is a sellout. That doesn't happen very often. It's 6:30 at the Plaza Branch. Maybe you can pay a security guard to get in if you want to hear and see Chris Leonard tonight. Chris, I'm wondering why you wanted to take on Coke Industries to begin with such a big book and such a big project. What drew you to Coke Industries?
Here's what drew me to it, is I had this realization in late 2011 that by writing about this one corporation, I could explore the entire American economy and political system. And the reason for that is because the company is so diverse, as we talked about. So when you're talking about this company, you're talking about blue-collar manufacturing workers who are watching their unions get torn apart. You're talking about high-flying financiers and derivatives traders earning millions of dollars a year. You're talking about corporate lobbyists who are shaping our public policy, literally writing our laws, all within the context of this one firm. So it really is, it goes from 1967 up until today, and it's kind of an economic history of how we reached the point where we are today, which I believe is an era when corporations have a role of preeminent power in our public life that they haven't had in 100 years.
Which is one more reason why Coke Industries flourishes today.
That's right. That's right.
You know, the New York Times says the book ranks among the best books ever written about an American corporation. And I should point out that in that review, the Times praised your even-handed approach, Chris, to this, you know, very controversial company. How tough was it for you to remain neutral and even-handed in the best traditions of American journalism?
Well, what was tough was to get inside and get the story. And part of that was this toxic atmosphere. And I am so grateful to the people who trusted me enough to tell me their stories.
Who maybe even risked their jobs to do so?
Risked their jobs, absolutely. And, you know, this is an insular, tight-knit community of people in and around the Coke network. So, yes, it came at pressure. But I just firmly think that we have overabundance of opinion today. In our media world, what I think people want is reporting.
Yeah.
People don't care what I think. I know that. What they do want to know is, how does this institution operate? How did it become so powerful? And some of these bigger questions about American society, what role should our government play in markets? You know, people want to just learn for themselves, and they don't need a reporter telling them what to think. That's for sure.
But you took on a private company here where information is hard to come up with. Again, referring to what the Times wrote about your book, the Times said that writing about the history of a private company without full access is akin to scaling El Capitan without handholds. That sounds about right to me.
It was not easy. And to be totally honest, I thought I was going to be done with this book years ago. But what it took was multiple trips to Wichita, Portland, Oregon, Oklahoma City, Atlanta, Georgia, New York. I live near D.C. and knocking on a lot of doors and just having the patience to ferret out those documents that tell the story and having time to go back and back and back to people to re-interview them. Some sources, it took 2 years for them to agree to go on the record for this project.
I was going to say, how did you even begin to figure out how to navigate a huge company like Coke? How do you begin to figure out who you can talk to and where you can go?
You know, I honestly, I just don't think it's that sophisticated. I flew to Wichita and I started knocking on doors of people who worked there. And I had six doors slammed in my face and then one door would open. And someone comes in and tells you their story and you can start to piece together how things work. And then with that knowledge, you can interview more people and get a bigger, better picture of what's happening. And I think the job of being a reporter, it's often like being a telemarketer. It's just making those calls and investing the time to find out what's going on.
So you didn't know eight important key people going into this project. You just had to make your way.
That's right.
Chisel your way through it.
That's right.
Well, you spent a lot of time in this book talking about how Koch Industries walked a very fine line between breaking the law and not breaking it, and sometimes getting caught breaking the law. Gino wants to talk about that now. Gino from Overland Park, you're on Up to Date with Christopher Leonard. Good morning.
Well, hello, gentlemen. I've been listening to the show, and I must confess that I missed the first part of it. But my question for Christopher is this. On the public perception of the Koch brothers is such that, and I believe after the studies I've done that is an accurate perception, is that they are one of the biggest forces for evil in the world. We have this existential threat to humanity, which is global warming, and they have done what appears to be everything they possibly could to damage the effort for the public to understand and do something about that. They have done more reprehensible things in business than almost anyone that I could name. My question is this, the part that I have heard the last 15 minutes or so, I hear a tinge of, more than a tinge of admiration in Stephen's voice. And I have to confess that it's, and with both of you, it's begun to irritate me now. Maybe that's unfair, but it sounds like we're talking, for the part that I've listened to, about one of your heroes.
Let me just be real clear here. You know, my glowing comments are about the book, not so much about the company, because Chris goes on at length in this book about different nefarious deeds of this company. Chris, go ahead.
Absolutely. I want to emphasize, if you please read the book, I don't think anyone would accuse me of lionizing these people or this institution.
No.
I'm very candid and very frank, for example, about the corporate lobbying around the issue of climate change. I feel like it's my job to document for readers what happened and how things work. And I do show Koch Industries played an unparalleled role in derailing efforts to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. I inserted an entire passage about the science of climate change, which is not complicated. Climate change is a very serious problem. And I just want to show the reality of what happened. And part of that is there are elements to this institution you have to perhaps call admirable, long-term thinking, long-term strategy. But there are other consequences of their power that people have to grapple with, such as derailing efforts on climate change legislation.
Let's talk about one of those incidents. A jury found Koch Industries guilty of falsifying documents to cover up its theft of oil on Native American land in the early 1980s. Why would the Kochs be stealing oil from Native Americans, Chris?
So this was a story early on in the company when Charles Koch took over for the first 20 years or so. Koch at the time in the 1980s was the largest crude oil gathering company in the United States. What that means is Koch was the company that would go out to an oil well, get the oil, take it to market. It's a tricky business collecting oil because it's hard to measure how much you took. And the evidence is simply overwhelming. It's all in the book that what Koch did for decades is it put its thumb on the scale. It would go out to a well, collect 100 barrels of oil, and then tell the owner that it had only taken 98 barrels, gathering 2 barrels a time without paying for it.
Right.
This went on for decades. Koch admitted in court they took $10 million of oil at least a year without paying for it. What's interesting to me is then how it contended with the consequences of those actions once they became public. The United States Senate investigated this oil theft. They directly accused Koch of theft. But when it came time to press criminal charges, Koch activated a political response that's really sort of the precursor for what you see today in their lobbying operations.
Hmm.
And it helped derail the criminal charges.
Yeah, there also have been numerous environmental breaches, too, like dumping ammonia-laced wastewater into the Mississippi, and they've paid millions in fines. Any sense of the company's reaction, their response to transgressions like these, Chris?
Well, a lot of this stuff we're talking about here happened back in the 1980s and 90s. Off the there's a chapter in the book called Off the Rails from the 90s. In the year 2000, according to reporting I did, Charles Koch told his top lieutenants, enough, stop. Get the EPA off my property. No more criminal charges. No more bad investments.
We're going to play it by the book.
That's right. And they have a theory called 10,000% compliance. You obey 100% of the laws 100% of the time. That's a real thing. This company did improve its operations. They don't flagrantly break the law in the way that they used to. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. My book shows that, for example, workplace operations at their Georgia Pacific division have gotten more dangerous over time and workers are being hurt more. That's a bad thing. But their response was real, that they do work very hard to comply with the law now.
There was a 1996 incident in which a Koch pipeline leaked butane vapors that led to an explosion that burned two teens to death. How much did the company pay out in that settlement, Chris?
Millions of dollars, and I don't know the exact dollar amount off the top of my head.
I say close to $300 million, wasn't it?
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so, well, I'm going by what I read, too, so yeah.
That explosion was the tip of the iceberg in terms of some of the operations. They had leaky pipelines, and it was this whole notion of putting profits ahead of safety is what was going on there.
Let's go back to some calls at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Cody from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Say, I'm very interested to know about the quiet funding for which the Koch brothers did to push in the Dakota Access Pipeline. They lobbied and advocated for that pipeline to go in. Meanwhile, Native Americans, as myself, were labeled terrorists. And, you know, we fought for the protection of our land and our cultural sites. And we're forever now looking at the fact that the Koch brothers, you know, quietly pushed this in.
What about the Dakota Access Pipeline, Chris? What can you tell us about their involvement there?
The Koch's relationship, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline carries crude oil from Canada. Koch has built a fortune off of crude oil in Canada. And I think it's actually a very important story. Koch owns a massive oil refinery in Minnesota. Nobody really knows about it. It processes almost entirely Canadian crude oil. That's oil that's relatively cheap because not many people can process it. Meanwhile, Koch can turn around and sell its gasoline into these very expensive gas markets in the upper Midwest. The reason I think it's important is that this is sort of a broken bottleneck in our energy system. Koch is one of the few refineries up there. People in the Midwest are paying very high prices for gasoline. Koch is paying very low prices for the oil it buys. And this is just an illustrative example of what happens when you're sort of the status quo player in a market like oil refining. You can just benefit tremendously when the system doesn't work well. And so Koch likes to talk a lot about fighting for free market principles, but sometimes all it has to do is do nothing to allow the dysfunction to continue, and it can reap large profits from it.
Huh. You begin the book by writing about the day back in 1981 when four Wall Street bankers traveled to Wichita to convince Charles Koch to take his then mid-sized company public and offer stock on the New York Stock Exchange. But this was amazing to me. He wasn't interested, even though this would have meant a huge payout to him at that moment. And this says a whole lot about Charles Koch. Why wasn't he interested, Chris?
So that passage was based on the memo that these J.P. Morgan bankers wrote when they got back. And you could just almost read the
astonishment. Yeah.
They fly and they say, take your company public, which was common wisdom at the time. He would have gotten $20 million, I think $25 million that night. Adjusted for inflation, that's like $60 million perhaps.
Yeah.
He tells them, no, go home. I'm keeping this thing private.
He wasn't even tempted.
He wasn't even tempted. And first of all, one of the fascinating quotes is he said, if we go public, people are going to learn how much money our commodities traders are making, and they won't trade with us anymore.
Huh. Wow.
That tells you a lot.
Yeah.
But then secondly, what he's saying is, I don't want to surrender control. And one of the things he did never wanted to become the servant of was short-term thinking.
Was beholden to the quarterly report that so many public companies struggle with today.
And how can you blame him? You've got these corporate CEOs obsessed about the next 3 months and maybe the next 6 months after that and what Wall Street is going to think about their every move. Charles Koch sidestepped that problem by keeping the company private, and boy, did he benefit from that.
Yeah, explain that to us, because you talk at length in this book about the benefits the Kochs have enjoyed as a result of long-term thinking, longer-term strategic thinking, which, you know, has given them ultimately a huge edge over lots of other people.
I think one of the best examples happened right here in Kansas City when Farmland Industries went bankrupt back in 2003. This was one of the largest agricultural co-ops in the United States, and Farmland owned these massive nitrogen fertilizer plants. Well, those plants went belly up in 2003 because of a spike in natural gas prices. Nobody wanted to buy those things. Koch Industries quietly walked into the bankruptcy auction and bought those nitrogen fertilizer plants for pennies on the dollar because those plants were losing millions of dollars a quarter. The publicly traded firms didn't want them. The people at Koch knew that the energy markets were going to change, that this was a down cycle, that there would be an up cycle. Since Koch bought those plants, they have turned into massively profitable assets. They're one of the biggest parts of Koch's portfolio now. So this shows how a company that's not afraid to lose money for a year or two and is not obsessed about what bank analysts on Wall Street are going to think can make moves that benefit them over decades.
It's almost amazing to me that Koch Industries hasn't become more of a model, at least in that regard, for more companies, because you don't see many companies like Koch.
You know, it's true. And they are, I don't want to use the word renegade, but you can just see how Charles Koch went against the grain to stay private. But you might remember last week, a group of corporate CEOs called the Business Roundtable released a statement that said, we need to operate our companies with more than just thinking about shareholder returns.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on in that statement, but one of the things was they're starting to realize the short-term thinking is demolishing the system of corporate America.
Well, maybe it's about time. Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date this morning. We're visiting with Christopher Leonard about Kochland, his new book, The Secret History of Koch Industries and Corporate Power in America. Our phone number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. I haven't asked you yet about their political influence, which obviously has been enormous, particularly this century. When did Charles and David Koch become interested in politics, and why did they go that way?
Well, they've been interested since the beginning. I mean, even in the 1960s. What is so fascinating to me—
Because their father was so involved, you're saying, with the John Birch Society.
I mean, I can't imagine what the dinner table conversations must have been in the Koch family. The dad was a co-founder of the Birch Society, which felt that the federal government had become infiltrated by communists and that New Deal programs were a front for communist tyranny. So yes, this is a conservative family. What Charles Koch understood from the beginning is that politics and economics are not separate things. They are intertwined. Okay? And the political economic system is essentially one thing. And he's been fighting since the 70s to make our country a libertarian, free market-based system where the government will not intervene.
When did they start Americans for Prosperity?
So this comes much later. For decades, Charles Koch was sort of a libertarian thinker, and Americans for Prosperity was founded in the early 2000s. And it was this sort of marginal group, but that gets flooded with money around the time Barack Obama gets elected. And it's now a nationwide group of what I would call boots on the ground activists. It's a mix of employees and volunteers. And so Americans for Prosperity can get people knocking on doors in neighborhoods in Iowa, South Carolina, you name it. They can get busloads full of angry voters from North Carolina, Missouri, Ohio, bring them to D.C. And I've been at these events where the people get off the buses, they're handed shiny protest signs, they're fed a boxed lunch, and then they're delivered to very specifically targeted congressional offices with vulnerable lawmakers where these average folks can complain about issues that Koch cares about. So it's truly an extraordinary arm of one of the largest lobbying operations in America that adds a feeling of heft or public sentiment, behind Koch's ideas.
You know, you can argue that they've had, you know, just simply enormous impact on the politics of Kansas going back years, you know, and including the rise of former Governor Sam Brownback.
Well, there's no question about that. Sam Brownback employed the Koch playbook on taxes. And we've seen some of the impact of that. One of the people I interviewed in this book is a guy named Tom Moxley, who was a state senator out of Kansas.
Huh.
No one's going to accuse this Republican from a small town in Kansas of being a liberal. But he saw firsthand how Koch was dramatically intervening in Kansas politics, oftentimes to serve its financial interests. You know, Tom Moxley became convinced that global warming is an urgent issue, that renewable energy could be a great economic boon to Kansas. But he watched as the Koch network dismantled efforts to stoke wind and solar power.
Let's go back to some calls at 816-235-2888 as we talk about Koch Industries here this morning. Ronald from Overland Park, you're on with Chris Leonard. Good morning.
Yes, I just wanted to know if in your research you found any connection with a man named James McGill, Buchanan.
A proponent of conservatism.
I didn't.
Right.
Was he the guy in the Nancy McLean book, Democracy in Chains?
Yes, he was. And so I was just wondering, she said that he had a very big influence on forming his political ideas and giving them structure and a philosophy that he could back up with all his money.
So I did not report heavily on that. And I'm familiar with the book, and I think it's a strong book. And I think what she did was captured a lot of the thinking of these libertarian philosophers like Buchanan and Baldy Harper was another one. I got a memo from a thinker named Murray Rothbard, who co-founded the Cato Institute with Charles Koch. And what you see across the board, I think, with these thinkers is a view that the government can only do more harm than good, that any government program, no matter how well-intentioned, is only going to create more problems than it solves. And, you know, the Murray Rothbard memo when they founded Cato was very explicit that, they called the government a thief and said taxes are sanctioned theft.
Wow.
And we ideologically must fight that. And they had a game plan to push for tax cuts. And then when you have deficits, push to shrink government. So, you know, this has been a longstanding sort of theoretical fight that they've been waging for a long time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Ronald.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Beth from Kansas City, Missouri. Beth, we're talking about Koch Industries. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. I have a question. We went to the Natural Museum of History in Washington, D.C., and we noticed that a lot of the exhibits were funded by the Koch brothers. How is their money influencing history and research?
History and research, Chris.
Well, here's my take on that. I've been in that wing, and this might be slightly unsatisfying, but here's how I see it. David Koch moved out to New York decades ago and lived a very public life where he liked to donate to cancer research centers and art events and things like that, Smithsonian wing. And he had his name on those events. It was David Koch who did those things. And those are more, I don't want to use the word superficial, but those are sort of high profile philanthropic donations that make you in good standing mm-hmm. with the Philanthropic Society of New York. I don't see them as deep, meaningful contributions that are trying to change the essence of science or research. I think he is more trying to be a good philanthropic billionaire citizen. Mm. Charles Koch, on the other hand, with David Koch, has had a tremendous influence. They've been channeling their money to reshape American politics. And they've been focused a lot on the Republican Party and getting the Republicans to be more libertarian. And I see that as the much larger effect, you know, the much bigger effect that this giving has had.
The influence on the National Republican Party, unmistakable, Chris?
Unmistakable. For example, I think Donald Trump's rhetoric around climate change was, Koch Industries laid the groundwork for that back in 2010 when the Tea Party movement came along. Koch very nimbly injected its concerns into the Tea Party movement and talked about how regulating greenhouse gas emissions was a form of tyranny and a move to take away the freedom of Americans. And so now, and Koch also very tactically, very pragmatically worked to get out of office any Republican who dared cross their orthodoxy on global warming. So now you have a Republican Party that can't even admit that this stuff is real. And I that's an unmistakable change.
I wanted to ask you about how the Kochs approached unions. Early in the company's history, Charles Koch bought the Pine Bend oil refinery up in Minnesota. It was controlled by a hostile union, which the Kochs eventually crushed. How did they do it?
They did it with that spine of steel that I mentioned earlier. Charles Koch is absolutely uncompromising, and he bought this very profitable refinery, but it was controlled by a strong, almost militant union. So Charles Koch hired a Texan named Bernard Paulson, who I interviewed for the book, who went up there to Pine Bend and essentially refused to negotiate with this union and said, here's how it is. Here's how we're going to run the refinery. Take it or leave it. And what ensued was a nine-month-long strike that was an absolutely brutal confrontation. I mean, the union even sent a freight train crashing into the refinery to try to kill everybody inside.
Wow.
That's how serious this thing was. And Charles Koch never backed down. And the theory is that the company needed to be run based on the laws of the market, not the demands of the union. This is a philosophical dispute.
But one of the underpinnings of what he believes.
That's exactly right. And at the time, in the early 70s, unions were very powerful in America. It's kind of stunning to go back and read that history. And, you know, for example, they imposed workplace rules that might have seemed onerous, that only a certain person could do a certain kind of job. But then you fast forward to the year 2016 and look at the employees working at Koch's factory floors now at Georgia Pacific. They have no control over their job. They're directed every day by a software system that tells them what to do. They often don't get a day off for weeks at a time. And internal Koch safety data shows workers are getting hurt on the job more often. Now that these kind of union-based workplace distinctions have been erased and you're doing multiple jobs at once, injuries increase. So it's not a clear, easy picture to contend with.
Just curious about what kind of response you've had to the book since it's been out.
Koch has been relatively silent about the book. I think that Koch is trying to push out their own positive story about what an entrepreneur Charles Koch is and how market-based management is a great thing. They want to focus on the positive. And I just think as an independent reporter, I kind of want to bring in more of the whole picture, the ups and the downs. And, that's been most of the response.
How is it for an author like you, after having spent 7 years on a project like this, you give birth to your baby, if you will, and out into the world it comes? Are you holding your breath for a few days to see what the first responses to it are going to be?
You're more just like about to throw up all the time, to be honest, because, years of work go into it. And what's so interesting to me is in the media landscape today, there's so much chaos and so much noise, and it also is pushing us toward really black and white views of things. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of room for, let's sit back and think about this for a long time. Let's look at the positive and the negative and maybe even challenge some of our own assumptions. So it is somewhat stressful to wonder if you can even get a little bit of attention in the chaos around. But, at the end of the day, it's the process of writing and reporting that's so great. And so it wasn't like I worked 7 years just to get this moment. Like, I really enjoyed those 7 years.
Chris Leonard has been my guest, the new book, Kochland. What a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Good luck with the book. Wish you all the best, Chris.
Thank you.
Monday's program, the CEO of Port KC explained that the agency's purpose and its sweeping authority, you can hear that conversation in other previous episodes, you'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Wednesday on the show, bullying is a constant concern, and we'll look at what the state of Kansas is doing to prevent it in its schools. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.